This is the first in a series of six cassettes on pastor counseling presented by Concordia Seminary Continuing Education Program Ministry Today. I am Dr. Paul Baumeister. Talking with me on this series is Mrs. Brenna Kitzberg of Lutheran Family and Children Services, a social worker, and the Reverend Alfred Bowles of Bethel Lutheran Church, St. Louis. The series is presented in six parts. Part 1, Beginning Counseling. Part 2, Evaluating. Part 3, Communicating. Part 4, Emotional Aspects. Part 5, Cognitive Aspects. And Part 6, Ending Counseling. On the flip side of these cassettes, the three of us will be discussing a role-played pastor counseling situation, which Pastor Bowles will record for us. Of course, the role-played situation is a fictionalized one, as are any examples we might be using along the way. To begin with, how about a definition of pastor counseling? Perhaps a good way to take off on that would be to discuss ways in which the counseling relationship differs from other pastor relationships. A difference that comes to my mind immediately is the way in which the relationship is structured. Mona, could you start us off on that?
Yeah, I think the structure relates to things like where are we going to meet, and when are we going to meet, when are we going to stop meeting, some time limits, in other words. Relates to questions like, will there be other people around, quite likely not, there shouldn't be. Relates to setting up the whole box, so to speak, within which the relationship between the counselor and counselor can get going.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we're moving towards some kind of definition of pastor counseling. A helping relationship, but then many pastor relationships are a helping relationship. Counseling is different from the others in that it takes place in a certain box, as you say, to come into the world. The box has to do with time and place. Would a pastor make some structural provisions about the kind of relationship? And you said that the relationship is different, closer, more personal. Would there be ways that you could go about establishing that?
Yes, I would like to say something first of all about the amount of time that the pastor is going to talk with the counselor can spend with the person who comes. As I recall my earliest years in the ministry, I think I had the feeling that if someone came to me for counseling and we were not getting in place, that this might be around for 6 or 7 years, if that's what the Lord and the person demanded. I can see a real necessity for some kind of period, some period of time beyond which you don't get a situation like this. I think that it's probably in a way kind of comforting to the pastor, the pastor, to see that these people constantly come back. But I think it also ought to be telling them that if you're not going in place over a certain length of time, then there either ought to be some kind of issue or some other direction ought to be given. And I think another point in setting up this situation is the pastor ought to remember that there is a professional aspect to this counseling that ought to be found when you set up a situation with someone who's coming in. I think for their benefit and for the benefit of the pastor, that idea of some kind of time situation, when they're going to come out, the situation where the person is met, these are things that a pastor counselor might very well take a look at. And not simply get the idea I'm here as a servant of all people and I can be with you at any place or any time for any length of time.
I think there's a key point that this bringing up here, and that is that in the counseling relationship, the pastor and the counselor have a definite purpose for meeting together. And that purpose is not to discuss church business. Is not to drink coffee together, is not to talk about other problems in the congregation or in the church, but it is to talk about the particular concern that the country is going to. And keeping that in mind can be a key step and a guideline for setting up some of the other things, for coming out where the meetings will be and how long they'll last.
They have a specific kind of content in mind. This is another piece of the box, huh?
That's right.
But we're not going to talk about just anything, but we're going to talk about a certain thing. For example, we're going to talk about your relationship with your 14-year-old or something. What the person has presented as the difficulty. Hmm?
Agreed.
Okay.
Both people are doing what they're going to talk about, and that's steps
and
structure.
And Pastor Bell, you were talking about a time limit. How do you go about arriving at a time limit? Do either of you have anything to say about that?
I think, first of all, the first aspect of the time limit would be seeing people at a particular time. And this is what I think is the thing that, that I have felt is necessary for the field of spirit with you. Because if you say to a person, I see you from 2:45 to 3:45 next Wednesday or next Friday, rather than saying, if you come any time of the day, or if you call me at night, I'll jump up and I'll rush out to see you. I think that this does a number of things. I mean, first of all, it does set a rather professional tone for what you're doing. And then you also get off the situation rather than sitting around for a long time being around the book. Remember that the person knows you've got from 1:45 to 2:45, and that's the time in which we're going to talk about this, and this is the way this is set up. And I think in most situations, I suppose there are some exceptions to this, but in most situations, this is a real necessity. The other thing is that with the over how long a time are you going to continue this counseling? And I think that this probably is somewhat going to be left to the individual counselor's judgment, but I think that if this goes beyond 10 or 12 weeks or beyond a certain length of time, then some other direction needs to be given. But it's really not good if you're really looking for some kind of answer. You're a year and a half or 2 years, and I could see this happening. Where somebody's pastor dealing with somebody and simply going back into the cemetery and the relationship goes on and on and on, and you're not really getting this place.
I could see some real dangers in kind of open-ended situation, conflict situation, where you don't set a termination date on at least by the second interview. Particularly with a counselor who, for one thing, has limited time to spend with this, right? Pastor has a lot of things to do with child counseling. And if you're going to carry people for years at a time, that's a lot of time to spend with one of the many people in your child. Also, the relationship gets more complicated as a counseling relationship continues. Ways in which the counselee begins to see the counselor, the ways in which the counselor might begin to misinterpret the counselor. So, there are kinds of instructions that would come in there, and I really begin to be a problem, because the pastor doesn't just have a counseling relationship, he also has a pastor relationship that includes many other dimensions. The kind of dependence that begins to develop between counselor and counselee. And as you suggested, Dr. Ball can go both ways. It makes the counselor feel pretty good to see these people coming back and meeting him again and again and again and again.
I think you've done several important points. from my point of view as a counselor who does counseling full time, we still need this kind of structure. A contract which will begin, say, in January and will end in March. And one of the primary reasons for that is this aspect of dependence. There are people in the world who, when they find someone who will be a good listener, who will be non-judgmental, who will help them through difficult periods, there are people who will keep coming back for years and years and years, and in effect lean on a conflict to help them solve their problems when, in fact, they could solve their own. Just a little push and a little help. And starting the contract and making it time limited in terms of weeks and months is frankly a protection for these people as well as for the country.
Mm-hmm. I think that I'd be interested in talking with you about how you go about setting those that kind of making that kind of contract. Not so much, I see that it's quite simple to say, you're right, we need it next week, and this is the time in which we need. I think that's not too difficult to do. That how you work with the person to set the length of time that you're going to cover. Or when you get to a certain point, say to the person, we're moving to the point now where either there has to be some kind of reason or something else has to happen. I think the one thing is, it can very easily happen that the pastor says, well, after a while, I have to, I'm a church pastor, and so I have to go beyond the call of duty. And it seems very hard sometimes. And maybe this is a personal hang up really more than it is a feeling for the other person. But the fact that you have to say, well, there's a limitation on the time of those things. But the pastor then gets the kind of feeling that this is really not what a pastor has to do. So that kind of thing of how you set the contract and set the time, I think, would be a good thing to talk about in more detail.
And I think there's another piece to that. And you just want to say, how does pastor see himself as a counselor? He usually is not a high strength psychotherapist, you know. He is really not in that business. But he is a counselor, and he can be very helpful to people as a short term counselor. You were suggesting some kind of limit of 12 times. I would agree with that. I think that is an excellent kind of number. That would allow you to see somebody once a week for 3 months. If it's going to go beyond that, my personal feeling is that the pastor should have special training and perhaps some kind of ongoing consultation.
Okay, sometimes it depends on the situation that people come to you with too. For instance, if there has been a tremendous crisis in a family or in an individual's life, we find with people that we work with that often they can talk through their feelings and their ideas about how to solve that crisis or how to change the situation from it, and it can be done in 6 to 8 weeks. You get a feel for how long it takes to get into the problem and how long it takes somebody to resolve it, and sometimes 6 to 8 weeks is enough. Another kind of situation might be the mourning situation, where someone has had a loss, either through death or accident or handicap or something like that. Often with 12 weekly session thing with some follow-up once a month for 2 or 3 months is very sufficient in helping a person work through the concerns you have about them.
Could you give us some words that you used, when you set a contract that has a time on the line? What words do you say to people?
Well, at the end of the first interview, I will say something like, it looks to me as if you can accomplish a great deal in 8 to 10 times. I would suggest that you meet for 10 times weekly, and that will take us to the end of February, at which time we'll have an evaluation session and decide whether there needs to be another referral or whether you want to make another contact with me, or whether things have sufficiently settled themselves so that you don't need to contact.
Do you put any more birds into the diet? Do you, you say time and place, of course. Do you talk about content at that time?
Oh, very definitely, because by the end of the first interview, I usually have a pretty good idea of what the key problem is. And I may paraphrase that, rephrase it for the counselee. For instance, a parent comes in and is quite distraught over the behavior of a teenager and feels that the teenager is acting in ways that are not helpful to him or her. And I, at the end of the hour, may have made the judgment that the real problem is that the parent and the teenager are not getting along very well, and that the genesis of some of the problems in school are at home. And I will say that I think there's a kernel of the problem at home in the relationship between you and your daughter and your son. And I think that this is a key that you need to look at and talk about and begin to explore, and that will help us then in resolving the situation at school.
One thing that's nice about your situation in agency is that the problem is relatively well defined by the time it gets to you. I think the problem that faces the pastor frequently is that he is dealing with problems much less well defined, and he then has the responsibility, if he's going to move from a pastor care role into a pastor counseling role, of making this transition. That means he's going to maybe be giving the people some initial feedback on his impression of a situation they've told him about, and then tightening the relationship up in terms of counseling and in terms of the contract and building the box and moving them from pastor care to pastor counseling. I wonder, Pastor Bold, if you can hear me comment about that kind of transition.
I think that, as I recall some of the things that I did in the past, I think, for example, that one of the things that happened to me on a number of occasions is that I would say to someone, I'm ready to, I'm ready to meet with you at any time, but not set a definite time. And I think that in many of these cases, those people never really came back on any kind of regular basis. For several reasons, I think. Occasionally, they would get into situations, I think, where they would reveal things that were probably a little difficult for them, and were not quite anxious to get back into another session. And then I left it so open-ended that I don't think it really meant anything to the people. And so very often it was a tough thing then to really build up some kind of a relationship again. Then I think there's something that has to be said about the counselor's own feeling. The fact that in many cases that I can think of, with the concept that the pastor wants to feel successful as a counselor, he's going to be left at the end of the road, because there doesn't seem to be there much success in some of these situations. So I can think of some marital conflict situations where I really couldn't feel a great deal of success in what was happening, whether it's success in the sense of solving the situation. And so, on the other side, if a counselor comes in and shows some kind of need for this pastor relationship, I think the pastor can misread this because of his own need of success. The person says, I really need to be meeting with you, and I'm really getting a lot out of this, and the pastor says, this is great. I'm getting a lot out of this too, and so then it's difficult to tighten this up and see this in a counseling situation, so that after all, I've got to look through those things and see whether we're really getting to the problem. And I have to set up these time limits
without the thought that my time is putting your time in a very grand way.
Might the pastor make this transition a very transparent kind of thing, and even say to people, you share a spot with me today, and it seems to me that that is the kind of time that might better be helped by the counseling relationship. And so I would suggest that we change our relationship for a while and pass the therapy, and I begin to function as a counselor for you for the next 6 weeks. Make it that much out of me from what you're doing now. Could that be what's the reaction to that kind of thing?
I think this is a good point to consider it. And probably I would add to this the whole way the counseling session is conducted. I think that maybe it's a good idea for a pastor to stop once and really think about the arrangement of the office and the way that the relationship right from the start with the person who comes in. Again, to some pastors, I think that a professionalism is being told, but it doesn't have to be. There are some of these things that ought to be seen. You're in a counseling situation. This is not just the ordinary counseling. I think for the good of the pastor counselor and the good of the counselee, so you're in for the office. And I think it could be very helpful to get this very clear. And I think that probably the counselee will feel much more secure in that kind of situation.
He might even begin to say something about his behavior, saying how his behavior is going to be different from how it usually is. For example, people usually expect the pastor to be comforting to them, and not verbalizing supporting statements, right? You might want to say something about that alteration as you enter a counseling relationship. You might want to say, I'm going to do a lot of listening. And I will say things when I have something that I think you ought to hear. You will find me behaving a bit differently as you get into a counseling relationship. You know, I need to see you behave. I might test you at times to explore certain areas that you don't want to explore. I might ask some very direct questions of you and expect the forthright answer. You might think that I'm invading your privacy. That's the time to be helpful to you. What do you think, Ben?
I think that's a great point, and I think it's a point that all counselors need to keep in mind. That part of the section of the first interview or the first visit is telling or talking with the people about what your role is. How do you handle interviews? You're, in a sense, educating people as to what counseling is all about, what the process is like. And you're educating them a little bit as to what they can expect from you. And as you said, Pastor Bill, that's very comforting. That's a very secure kind of thing to do. It makes it easier for the person to come back the second time if he has some idea what to expect.
Another piece of that would be giving advice. You know, people with problems come to their friends, and from their friends they generally get comfort and then they get advice. Maybe to say a word or two in an initial interview about how you are not going to make decisions for people. They will make their own decisions.
I find a helpful guideline to be that when a person comes to me for counseling, we can make some assumptions about them. We can assume that they're in a turmoil sometimes. We can assume that they're somewhat frightened at the new situation. This is the first time coming to ask for help. We can assume that because they're asking for help, they feel less than able to handle their everyday life. Which puts them in a kind of dependent position, a dependent feeling. We can assume that they may be a little hostile a little suspicious, because after all, quote, the counselor, the professional, is going to be asking me to do something that I'm not comfortable with. We can assume that there's some hope. After all, they wouldn't have come too if there hadn't been some hope that things would get better. So if you assume that these are some of the feelings that the counselor is having, then studying the structure and explaining who you are and how you will act is very important to them.
How about what do you feel about the attitude and effect that the pastor or counselor needs to have? I think there's an area of possible conflict here. Pastors stand in pulpits on Sunday and wax prophetic and talk about sin and the troubles with the world and with the society and with people's behavior. And this is the same man now who is supposed to be a counselor on Monday and deal with people, assist them in talking about the kind of problems they have. Do you feel conflict there, Pastor Bolt?
Yes, and I'd like to take just a quarter step back and tie in with counseling expectation of a pastoral counselor, which I think deals also with the counseling and the pastor's feeling. I have a feeling that with someone who encourages called a professional counselor, the counselor may see that person in a professional role. I think that with the pastor, they will possibly, and maybe it's because of the way that the pastor's projected, take a different attitude. And consequently come in and say, now here's the pastor, the personal pastor, I really can't expect him to be giving me all the answers he's going to give with me in this way. But the pastor, with expectation, usually the answers, which he's sort of grown up with, as it is. And what that kind of expectation can do to the pastor, or as a pastor, you're always going to be speaking to me, you're not going to be evasive to me, you're not going to come off asking me to settle with some of these things. And I think that expectation of the pastor can be a terrific problem for the pastor counselor. And I think it is important that we come to grips with our own feelings, and that we learn to separate the kind of things that we do in teaching and the next of our the pastoral ministry. And then we come into a situation like this and know exactly how we feel about these things and realize that who you're dealing with is someone who wants to get a hold of life and get a redirection of life.
Okay, we've been talking about beginning pastoral counseling. We worked on a definition of pastoral counseling, on a distinction between pastoral care and pastoral counseling. We thought a bit about some of the limits of pastoral counseling, the structure involved regarding time, place, content, relationship. We talked about setting the contract between the pastor as counselor and the counselee, about making the transition that needs to be made from pastoral care to the more structured pastoral counseling relationship. And we touched on the feelings and expectations of both the pastor and of the counselor.
This is part two of the pastoral counseling series. We'll see again today with Lena Fletcher, Special Worker, and Al Bull, Pastor, and Dr. Bionaster. Today we'll be talking about evaluating in the counseling process. As a general statement, I would say that evaluating is something that goes on all the time in a counseling relationship. It's not the first thing you want to forget about. It's a constant process that you're involved in as a counselor. It begins with the first contact. I'd like to draw a distinction between observation and report and conclusion that I think is valuable. Observation is what you see with your eyes. according to what people say, which is synthesis and conclusions are what you think about what you see and hear. Okay? What sort of things would you be looking for you would be consciously evaluating? What kind of observations might go into your evaluation of a person before you?
Well, I'm looking for non-verbal communication primarily. I'm looking for body postures. I'm looking at ways of relating to me. I'm looking for tone of voice. And I'm drawing an inference from what I see as to what the emotional state of the person is. That is a fearful. Is he angry at me? Is he hostile towards somebody else? And does that come across non-verbally? Secondly, I am looking for a discrepancy between what the person acts like and what he tells me. In other words, I'm looking for a discrepancy between my observation and the person's report of himself.
Mm-hmm. And might part of what you pay attention to be something like women and death?
Very much so. If someone comes into my office not well groomed, not looking as if he's caring about personal appearance, this is one indication, one clue that I kind of tuck away. Because it may say to me that this person is in a depressed state. It's beginning to go downhill in terms of not caring how he relates to other people. So, personal appearance is very important.
The 35-year-old lady who comes with a very good or this time the way 35-year-old lady
who yeah, well, another example, a 35-year-old lady who comes in dressed like a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
Mothers who really look like 13-year-old daughters, but sometimes it's a good problem, sometimes not.
Something that's going on in society now is that the youth dress style, which of course all our expectations are, because
that's why it's so important not to draw a final conclusion or a final inference. You gather some clues, some puzzle pieces, and you cut them away, and you pull them out at the next session, and you ask yourself, did what I see last time, does that correspond with what I see now?
Mm-hmm. This would be particularly true for the pastor equation. Possibly see these people in a number of different situations. It could be people speaking and asking a lady to somebody, a lady there, or even in their own home. And maybe the observations are valid, and maybe they're not. But I think that the pastor generally would have much more contact with the people beforehand, before they come in, than they talk to them out.
That's kind of a beautiful that is wrong, you know. If you do get an opportunity to see people in all kinds of situations, to see them in groups, to see them with their own family, to see them in their own home, and then you can have to see them one by one, particularly if you talk to them. Part of what goes on in the feeds into the evaluation process is what the person says about himself. Something that many counselors have noticed is that people, when a counseling process is begun, seem to feel that they need to present what's sometimes called an abuse of a judge that will gain the attention of the counselor, will be important enough to pay attention to different people. What do you do when you get the feeling that somebody's presenting their admission to it?
So first of all, I pick up on what I think they are feeling inside. People give us admission tickets because they're not sure they're going to be accepted, I think. They're not sure they're going to be listened to. And this is why the story that they tell us in the beginning is often not the real concern. They're telling us what they think we want to hear. And somehow, we have to make it clear that we're willing to listen to whatever they want to say. So, for instance, a woman who called me in tears saying that she would like to talk about herself and her husband, and then he comes into my office and spends half an hour talking about their children. There's a discrepancy there, you see, and it behooves me to ask the question at some point in that first hour, is this what is really concerning you right now? Is Johnny's behavior still a real problem?
You ask that question.
I'll ask that question. Generally, towards the end of the first hour, it wouldn't be the first thing that I'd say. Because I want to establish an atmosphere of listening to anything, and sometimes people will spontaneously come out with a real problem after they've handed me their ticket. It's important how one tells it. You have to have a kind of a long tone in your voice, a non-judgmental tone, a non-punitive tone. You have to get across by my non-verbal that you're willing to listen to anything. And this is a key question for me. Is this the real problem at this time? Or is there anything else you want to share with me?
I think the answer sometimes to many of those things is that the admission ticket that people present is a kind of spiritual one. Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, that's right. Someone will come in and talk about the eventually to be a Christian, or give that kind of eventual faith to them, or what the wonderful thing marriage and the family is. And I think that I have on occasion let this go and then said, do you want to talk to me again? And you just said, then the real thing starts coming out. Or I'll say, when they're talking about them, how great the Christian life is, or how great their family life is, ask them to repeat this in some way, or say, such an other thing, sometimes it's hard to call it. But occasionally, this is where it's coming from, and they're going to think
of it. I've had people come and say, Pastor, I had a spiritual problem. And I'm going to you because it is a spiritual problem. And your friend and my friend, they realized my family needed to be spiritual in some context. And then we talked about the spiritual problem, which, might be on the same thing. I have difficulty believing in the forgiveness of sin. Maybe you have a spiritual problem. Maybe that's the main content of what's wrong, but maybe if it's an admission ticket because you're pastor, and I think we need to be tuned into that possibility. Not that we go around being told that the church is never giving us a question, but that we're aware that there could be another possibility involved. One of the first things you're going to want to find out as a person tells this story is just what is the history of the difficulty of bringing him to you. You might get into that by asking a question like, how long is this thing going on? Do you ever do that kind of thing now?
Almost all the time. Generally, in the first few interviews, I'm not interested in gathering a long, long history of that person's whole past life, because often that comes out spontaneously as we're talking.
The cozy part of it, yeah.
Right. The important things will come out. People will always tell you. But I am interested in knowing what caused them to call. Why did they call this weekend rather than last weekend, for instance? Because you can generally assume that something happened that upset them enough so that they reached out for help. And it's important to know what that precipitant was, what that precipitant was that helped someone feel that they needed that. So I always ask the question, what caused you to come now? Why did you come now?
That, I think, leads us stumbling into the next thing we want to talk about. I see the evaluation process as involving three basic questions for the counselor. Two questions that he has to answer for himself somehow. The first one is, what is the problem? And the second one is, what are the resources? And the third one, the follow-up from one or two, is, who does the helping he's going to do it? As you would begin to find out about the duration of the time, how long you've had it, if you're doing then, you move into area one, and you're saying, what is the problem? How are we going to define it? How are we going to think about it? I think it's important to have some categories in which to think about the problem. I have several categories that I think are useful. I'm going to talk about four of them. Let me just run through them quickly. Psychotic problems, problems having to do with anxiety or depression, type 2, and type 3 would be problems of control, and type 4 would be problems in living. My feeling is that in problems that are reduced, psychotic difficulty, that means people are really out of touch with reality. Their talk doesn't make sense. They are maybe behaving in very bizarre and unusual ways. Find their difficulties in reaching them. Maybe find their difficulties in understanding them. It really doesn't make sense to you. These are clues that what you have in front of you is possibly a psychotic problem. And my feeling is that the pastor does not try to handle a psychotic problem by himself. That he really needs a psychiatrist. And maybe somebody who can make use of a hospital and use of medication and other physiological treatments that is kind of difficult. The pastor might be helpful in a psychotic problem. Later on, maybe, if a person has had psychotic difficulties, he may have a lot of other relational problems in living. He may have problems with mood at times, but the person can be very helpful. Problems with anxiety or depression will confront the pastor in time. Here, I would be quite concerned about two factors, severity and duration. Seems to me that counseling, short-term counselor might be for people, would be very helpful for someone with a mild depression that is not been going on for more than 2 months. And if he needs to have been around for longer than that and not gotten better by itself, maybe perhaps we ought to think about referring that person to someone else who can stick with it and not live in it. Maybe he has training and equipment that perhaps doesn't have.
Maybe it would be helpful to think of how these anxiety and depression problems come up. If they're relatively mild and relatively workable, that is, we can help the people with them, they generally come up as a reaction to something that has happened. For instance, a depression that has come up in reaction to a death or a loss of some kind, a handicap, an accident, a house fire that took everyone's belongings. Anxiety can be stirred up, for instance, in a 50-year-old mother who lost her at that time. And she faces a long period of her life you've got to come in a new role and you can ask for yourself. So the key, as I see it, would be, one of the keys would be, is this feeling, either anxiety or depression or sometimes guilt, is that a reaction to something else?
Maybe what you're asking is, does it make some kind of sense in terms of recent history, recent occurrence, and so if something changed in a person's life that makes his emotional reaction understandable to us?
Exactly, and that's why it's so important to ask the question, what happened just before you started doing this?
Mm-hmm.
It's more important to get the recent history.
It's a function. People will not put things together like that themselves. Or sometimes they will and feel they're perfect about it. Person who's depressed too long after his death, put together for himself. I am having a difficulty because my husband died. I know that. But still not be able to do anything about it, not know enough about the process to be able to assist it and be able to deal with the mourning that needs to go on. In terms of anxiety problems, not to depress you, but the heavy anxious uneasiness state, my feeling is, if there are intense, irrational fears that really are immobilizing to the person, which perhaps you care beyond what the person would want to hear, I think it's telling them that to consider the horrible fears that are there on the table. It's part of the drug, two blocks away, it makes the child testify to the glances, he trembles, he will rearrange his car, he passed the school by 7 inch block in order to avoid every dog behind the fence unit. That kind of anxiety problem is the kind of thing that more than the 12 hours I have to do.
So the pastor ought to develop some kind of relationship with the people out of the profession, at least that's familiar with them. It seems to me that in cases like this, there could be some kind of literature that could be helpful in knowing should I or should I not. I think this is important because there is this feeling, I think the pastor can have this feeling, like I'm really not doing my duty if I'm a specific person. And on the other hand, the other side of it is that too quickly you feel that there is an alternate indicator something about you and what the person may feel the pastor is not interested. And so one of the things that would be very helpful is to be able to talk to somebody who can give some indication of the situation and some idea of just how to reconcile the life. But to do this, you really have to know some of the people in the community.
The thing that I like more and more as I think about this sort of thing is the pastor is a trusting counselor. And that's completely legitimate thing because it's a way to be very helpful to people, but you can't be helpful to everybody. But he's not a psychologist, and he's not a psychologist, he's not a social worker. This is like that's a thing you might want to do something in addition to a self-care counselor, not going to be a long-term counselor. But he is still in a slightly different spot from people who have to handle everything that comes to them. The pastor has the perfect right to be somewhat selective and realistic. In fact, he is the professionally responsible to do that. He's doing the merit, he's community professionally responsible. So, talk about psychotic problems, anxiety, and depression problems. You know, how about I really feel about control problems? I think maybe the main kind of problem that's going to be in this category would be
Well, two kinds. One is intuitive, who typically feel controlled by the time. They're just a good running wild. Poor impulse control, poor judgment. And the other kind is going to be people with alcohol and drug problems. Here I think it's important to make a distinction between those kinds of situations where the pastor can be helpful and those kinds of situations where it isn't going to be necessary. And once again, the history is important. How long has this been going on? You have someone in front of you who is 35 and has a history of difficulty in controlling impulse that goes back to time he was 12 and he stole his first car. And he's still writing bad stuff and going out every morning and he just can't hold his job more than 3 months, but he's a good guy at selling his cars. Or it's encyclopedia or something like that. I would say you're dealing with something that's not going to change much. 12 hours of something is going to be about where we are right now.
I think it's important to underline that because there are people with control problems whom nobody can change. It's not a reflection on the cancer if you can. Because a social worker, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, no one in institution or society today can change these people either. We're essentially talking about a third subcategory under control problems. The adult who basically is an adolescent or a pre-adolescent kid. In terms of all the things that we expect adults to do in our society, holding a job, being able to have a close relationship with helping our wives and children, these are things that adults with control problems often can't do.
It is that. We are probably very much, if you were to go to the state prison and talk with people there, what you would say would be about control problems. A place where a pastor can be helpful, I think, with a control problem is with a younger person, but a person who might still qualify as a teenager or almost teenager. Some people get their control a little later in life, like they're in 22, 23.
But that's not unusual. We have laid out a
relationship. Yeah. Right. And that can be very helpful in that kind of situation by providing some external control, by being talking about reality. You know, what happens when you don't control any questions? You do get control. By labeling the problem, maybe you can have an impulse control problem. But both of those problems in living, I've been feeling there, specific relationships seem to go wrong. And there's more difficulties with the question, maybe the question secondary to the relational difficulties. There's more difficulty in control, really, that's not the basic problem. But, for example, if my life is going along well, in every aspect, except I'm having just a terrible time with my 14-year-old son, then I would pass by all the problem with him. And there's a class that seems to pick him out of the Or if everything is beautiful and I'm having trouble with my wife, or with my boss, or with one of my colleagues, and talk about this as a problem in living. I would say this is really primary of the pastoral intervention of the council to talk about the relationship with who the other person is, to try to deal with the feelings involved and make the most of that kind of situation.
Isn't it also worth remembering that in some of these cases that you've been talking about, the pastor would have the opportunity again to be working not only with the person, but very likely with the family. In a case such as this, or even with this control problem, that probably could be very helpful. to help the family see that they are not prepared for a point like this.
Families often need to know that the teenager with impulse control problems, that this is normal, a normal stage in development. The adult with impulse control problems is another story, and the family maybe needs some help in learning the power, but it's a test themselves with mastery.
Yes, it's a test themselves. Maybe the occurrences that happen when a control problem has dealt around. Okay, let's move quickly to point two. What are the resources that the pastor has to deal with? He can be a counselor himself. He can be referred to any number of other helpers around. He can refer and stay involved as pastor. He can opt out for a while. What kind of funding resources are there? Knowing the resources in the community, really, and knowing the financial resources of the people in the community.
The pastor needs to know his own feelings about this, too. If he's going to be suspicious of a psychiatrist or the other resources available, then he's got to take a good look at this.
Good way to get to know somebody too, is get a allotment in your budget for taking somebody to lunch in a while. And take a drink for lunch and get to know him and find out if he's a man you can trust and why he's so kind of true. I say that happy just like you too, I think. So if you get to know this man, man to man, you can be very different to the guy and he's very often to the bottom somewhere if he's mean.
On a most important level, you can use the rural relatives, you know, if you're in a large city. All you have to do is look at social service agencies to find out what kinds of family agencies are available and what kinds of mental health clinics. You can look up psychiatrists and psychologists, and you can call these people. Most family service agencies would be glad to get a call from a pastor and explain what they do and how they do it. I'm thinking of pastors in rural areas where there aren't very many resources. For instance, one could still use the resources in the city for consultation help for decision makers where referrals could be made.
I think that in large cities there will be some sort of coordinating with these cities. There hasn't been any resource service. Mental Health Association, St. Louis has a resource service you can call there. Find out the most appropriate resource in town for a specific problem. Okay, we will talk today about the evaluation part of the counseling process. We talked about the difference between observations, reports, inference, and conclusion. We talked about the patient's admission ticket. We talked about history. And we've listed some categories of human problems. Psychotic problems, anxiety and depression problems, control problems in living. And discussed the three questions that the pastor needs to answer for himself as he evaluates. What is the problem? What are the resources? Who knows what happens? We've been talking about the evaluation process today.